Welcome to the Profit Talks podcast, hosted by the Orange County Inland Empire SBDC Network, funded in part by the U.S. Small Business Administration and the California Office of the Small Business Advocate. This show is the go-to resource for business owners seeking empowerment, education, and resources to succeed. Join us as we connect you with experts, share the triumphs of fellow entrepreneurs, and reveal the wealth of assistance available to you today to level up your business. So let's go. Let's dive in and learn more. Well, I hope you listened to the last part about learning more, because we're going to learn some more about cult and classic films than you probably ever wanted to know before. It is certainly they're both hot genres today, and two things that I'm very hot to talk about and very familiar with. And I'm pleased to have with me somebody who knows even more about them, Nathan Wycliffe from Cult and Classic Films. Welcome, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's Wyckoff. It's very hard to say. Nobody wants to say it the way it's actually said because it sounds funny. It was a good name to go through school with.
I am so sorry for that.
No, you're fine. You're
nothing
fine.
About getting names wrong here. Well, Okay. I'm glad that you joined us. You do something that I know few. I do know somebody else. We'll talk about it a little bit. But I do not know many people who focus on cult and classic movies. Let's start with the passion. Why did you delve into this space at all here?
Oh, well, I've been a critic for many years. And as just about any critic will tell you, except for the most famous, it is not going to be your only job. So it's always been like a side passion for me. And I think this isn't true always, but when you get really invested in learning all aspects of film as a critic, you go beyond the movies that are readily available to you, which we call the mainstream movies, you know, right. The ones that are in the theaters the most often, the ones that are planned TV the most often. And it's not that there's anything wrong with them necessarily, but you just end up wanting more. It's that insatiable desire, you know, just like anytime anybody gets super invested in something, they want to know more. And then you get into the cult realm, which is kind of the next thing, you know, and that's really deep and it's full of movies that people don't remember. Maybe they were really popular at one time. Maybe they were not well received, but they have a fan following.
Yes.
There's stuff like that. And then even beyond cult, there's sort of the underground ultra low budget film world, which, you know, it crosses the cult genre. But unless you actively look for it, for the most part, you just won't see it. And that's we sort of exist in all of those realms, but we mostly are in the cult and the ultra low budget crowd, because as a small business too, those are small business people. Those are people who are literally, maybe they even only have their phone and a backyard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. But they're making movies, and that is anybody that's been involved in any movie making process or watched a behind the scenes documentary knows that is a huge undertaking, no matter what the size.
Yes, exactly.
So
you've had this passion for it. This interest in it, and particularly what some of us would think of almost bizarre films, strange films, films that people pan and say, I can't watch this thing. It's the invasion of, Santa Claus versus the Martians. All these other crazy low-budget films or sci-fi films or horror films, some of which have gone on to cult status. Things like, the whole Saw series. I think that was didn't that start as a pretty low budget film?
Pretty low budget. That's right. And of course you have ones that everybody knows, even if they've never really seen or been a part of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, it was critically panned, of course. And people
lined up.
Absolutely.
Midnight showings of this for years on end and knew all the lines and would dress up as the characters and recite the lines out loud and all this crazy stuff.
Yep. And there's even a lot of films people don't really realize have become mainstream icons because of their cult status, like Hocus Pocus with Bette Midler, and it did fantastic cast, Sarah Parker, everybody. It was not well received critically, particularly, but because people watched it and liked it, and it helped because it had cast members that they recognized, so they went to see it. Right. That brought it back. And now you ask a lot of critics and they're like, oh, it's a wonderful family classic. But at the time, that's not how they felt, you know?
Exactly.
So it's cult films in general are really like the people putting the power in the enjoyment of the film, right? Like, they're the ones that like it and love it, and it no longer matters how the critical acclaim or the box office proceeds were for that movie.
So let's take it apart a little bit here and see if we can understand the appeal of this. Maybe that's too much, but I'll say fringe genre. This fringe, you know, this stuff that the general public may or may not even be aware of that's made, but has following a fanatical following that will watch, yes, like the Rocky Horror film. So I had a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine years ago. We both studied film different places, and he was fascinated with bad movies. And he's not alone. Many filmmakers I knew were fascinated with, for example, what is his name? Ed Wood, who did all the, mm-hmm, supposedly some of the worst films
Plan
ever.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
From Outer Space. That was the one he always would tell me about. And then they ended up making a movie with Johnny Depp, kind of about this guy's life.
That's right.
Here.
Tim Burton produced that movie, yeah.
And what is it about people who, and Ed Wood didn't know he was making bad movies. He really was trying to make good movies.
Yeah.
But they were so awful, they were good.
Well, yes.
What is it about that there's something that intrinsically valued? If I see a car that's poorly built, I'm probably not attracted to owning one here. Maybe there's cult followers of, you know, some lousy car, the Rambler from the 60s or something here.
I was like Datsuns. Yeah.
There you go.
So it's really interesting. I find that a lot of film buffs who really, you know, like me, get deep into it, they actually do have this, like, passion for bad movies, that the mainstream would. And I think there's two reasons that I could point to. One is it's something new. Bad movies are often, they may not understand always what rules they're breaking of good filmmaking,
right,
but sometimes they do things that we don't expect because they're not aware or beholden to those conventions. So sometimes it's just a refreshing change. For example, and this isn't to knock any mainstream movies, but some movies that are absolutely beloved, like Saving Private Ryan,
right,
or The Thin Red Line, war movies are, to me, are a big one that do it. They actually tend to follow well-trodden plots. You know, you could pull a science fiction plot, a drama film plot, all of them, and many of them you could just lift the basic plot, you know, who starts, who ends, how it ends, and place it over those movies, and you know you're going to be able to predict exactly what happens. There's some value in that movie, not just because escapism, we want to live somewhere else for a little bit, or excitement, you know, there's great action set pieces, but we know what to expect. And the more movies you watch and the more you start thinking deeply about them, I mean, it was with a literature background, which I have, we call it critical analysis or critical thinking, right? You don't just watch the surface and consume, then you think about it over and over again. Why did this happen? Why am I thinking about this part that seems small? What's making it stick in my head? And with bad movies, or quote unquote bad movies, or strange movies, as you said, fringe is actually probably a pretty good description for a lot of them. They're just, whether intentional or not, they're breaking boundaries and rules that we don't see very often. And sometimes it actually later will become a convention to do what they did. So one aspect, it's surprise. It's an area where we can learn things that we didn't know, even if it's from a bad movie, even if the movie itself was not something we consider a successful film, right? Meaning to me, it wasn't entertaining, or it was not
well done.
Exactly. There's a technical problem.
You can see set fall over. Or you can,
the sound, you can barely hear anyone. That's a big common one. But there's a value in it. The second reason that I find the most interesting is that you can see an authenticity in a movie that's sort of a bad movie, like an Ed Wood movie. Mm-hmm. That is harder to spot in many larger productions. And I think there's a couple of reasons I'm sure that play into that. One is a large movie like a famous flop, Tom Wolfe's, the adaptation of Tom Wolfe's book, Bonfire of the Vanities, by Brian De Palma.
With Tom Hanks in it. Wasn't Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks, Bruce Willis.
Not for want of a big cast and a big book.
Huge budget. They kept going over budget. And unfortunately, I can't remember the author's name, but there's a very famous book that followed the production. Film journalist was with them, and I recommend that book highly. But there are so many people's hands in the pot, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We think of a movie being made by the director. Okay, if we know a writer, we think of it as being written by the writer, and the director takes that script and just films it.
And
it's not really what happens.
And films, supposedly, unlike a play where it's all the writer.
Exactly.
And the director has less impact on it. The director has huge impact on a film and a script. The
Absolutely.
Script today might go through many rewrites and many hands touch it. It isn't just a singular product, but it tends to be a singular vision of a director.
And you hear a lot of, especially if you talk to directors, you hear a lot of nightmare stories with producers. And producers are not necessarily the enemy of film, but they can be a struggle point in a film's production because they're the ones fronting the money for the production. So if they have a fear of the X, Y, and Z choice that the director or the writer wants to make or the actors want to make, that they're afraid it's going to lose them money because it's not going to work or the audience is not going to like it, they're going to push back. And when you have that push and pull in the outside world, sometimes that leads to a good compromise. Mm-hmm. But in the film world, often it leads to a bad movie because you don't have follow through with any of the ideas consistently. You know, the director may have one idea. I want to push this as the main theme through the movie, and I'm using visuals to do that.
Right.
But then the producers come in and say, no, we have to change this part. And then all of a sudden,
we got to put some car crashes in there. We got to put some sex scenes in there. We got to do something.
Right? They want it to sell. And there's some famous examples where, you know, production was wrong. And there's various stories about this, not to put anybody on the spot, but Jerry Bruckheimer is a very famous producer, and he produced the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. And the first film, especially Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow, was sort of, it blew everyone away. His portrayal of that character was out there. It was unique. There was a lot of physicality to it. And originally, the producers wanted a very, I think the term was even used, Captain Morgan from Captain Morgan's Rum, like the famous pirate standing on top of the booty, you know, like this very gallant, regal character.
Right.
And so they were really concerned about Gore Verbinski, the director's choice, to go with Johnny Depp's version. But eventually they
Who is basically playing, as he admitted, Keith Richards, a drunken Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones here.
Yeah. Yes, who himself had a small role in, I think, the third or fourth one. Right. I forget which one. So it's fascinating, right? Because we see these things, they become famous choices. The Godfather, I think it's probably the best American film ever made, has a hugely troubled production history. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola locked himself in a room several times, and just a nightmare production.
And Al Pacino talked about many times that he really thought he was on the verge of being fired because he was playing so subdued, so quiet.
He almost quit sometimes, yeah. And they didn't want to hire Marlon Brando because at that point they considered him kind of washed up, and he was also notoriously difficult to work with if he didn't like the production. But again, came out one of the best products ever. So you don't always know. And that's a big thing about film. They're huge risks with money.
Right.
When these small, ultra-low budget films, which could be anything from making a movie with whatever you have in your house to, $5,000, $15,000 that you get from other people. Those movies, there's a passion. You have to want to make that movie. No one thinks they're going to break big with a $500 budget and their friends.
Right.
They don't think they're going to break big. And it's a lot of work. It's not just filming the movie. You spend probably more time, usually more time after you film the footage, making the movie, then you do filming it. So while we see, especially if we're friends who've been in a production, many of us have been in friends' films for a school project or et cetera, you get this sort of, you just get this little bit. You're like, oh, it's fun, or it's a long day, but you know, it was over in a day. That's not what it's like for the filmmakers, right? You have to care about it to make it. And that does come through, even if it's a bad movie. And they're often bad movies.
And they put themselves out. They run their credit cards up. They borrow money from everybody and their brother.
Oh, man.
Anything
that's
they
so
can
much.
Do to do that, to make this little vision, knowing that the odds of it succeeding are so small. Now, I was in Hollywood. I was an entertainment publicist for a number of years. I worked on films. I worked with famous actors and celebrities and stuff here. I went, this is like the 80s and stuff here. And I was amazed, two things. One, how they really don't know what they got till they get in the editing room and start cutting it together. Mm-hmm. They thought this was brilliant when they saw the rushes in the media the day after. But then as they assemble it, this is a mess. And what are we going to do with it? Or it falls apart in the editing room. And I thought it was good, but this is turning out lousy. They really don't know. The actors don't know. Nobody, the director doesn't know. The producer doesn't know until they really get in and cut it and show it. Sometimes even then they show it to people and it bombs. We thought this is brilliant. It's horrible. The other thing that surprises me is the high risk. 1 million-to-1 shots that you're going to make in Hollywood, that film's going to make it.
And just when you think it has to be a complete formula, like you said, and when I studied screenwriting at UCLA, oh my God, there was only five or six basic plots that you're supposed to put into every mm-hmm. movie, boy meets girl, the buddy film, the hero's journey, you know, there's just yep. standard little templates. And then somebody would come along and do something like My Dinner with Andre, I'll never forget yeah. that, where they just talk mm-hmm. for an hour and a half in the same room. Unheard of. Or you see low-budget films, Easy Rider, that they shot on a shoestring and it went on to earn hundreds of millions of dollars. They exactly. hit that moment in time.
Or the Blair Witch Project.
You know, yeah. oh, my God. And so these little shoestring-budget movies, $100,000, $50,000, and well under $1 million, turn into multi-million-dollar hits for That's the right. craziest of reasons. So does that motivate people to keep trying, or are they just trying to... Is this the first step in being a filmmaker? You got to make a bunch of little student films and bad films before you get to make a good film.
Well, I think it's one of those things, like any creative field, anybody that tells you they know how you can become a success is lying. They're probably not to be trusted. Right. But it's true. Some things just break through, like the Blair Witch Project, which I'll definitely want to talk about in a second, because there's some really important things about why I started the business that you can see in that movie. But there's also cases where, yeah, people just keep working and then they meet someone. Going to conventions is a big thing. If you're a fan of horror or science fiction or any film, right. meeting people, it really is a network. Like, that is something that is so critical. And actually, the small business organizations like SBDC and all the branches and everything are kind of like that. Like, you end up meeting people, and then your reference point there, like mine was Lisa Napolitano, was fantastic. Right. She then sent me to Ryan Stoll, who's great at advertising and digital media marketing and all these things. And you just get to know these people, and they know people. And then it really does. It matters. And also how you work with people matters, right? Just a yeah. quick thing. Like, right. you never want to burn a bridge that is not, you just consider the risks, right?
You're going to see them on the way up and you're going to see them on the way down.
That's right.
So you might get twice the run of the first. Well, we'll get into the SBDC in a moment, because I think that's a fascinating part of this too, how you Absolutely. Doing something I wouldn't think the small business development centers would have anything to do with, mm-hmm. not just making movies and distributing movies, but that's cult, right. fringe, horror, sci-fi, low budget, all this stuff seems the most risky and the most out there mm-hmm. and the most unlikely to benefit from the 100+ consultants. But yet you clearly hit
huge
some.
Help. Yeah.
Huge help.
So just to take an example, when you're a small filmmaker, you want, it's just like any creation. It's like your child. You want wow. it to be out there. You want it to do well. You want people to see it and go, wow, what a great kid, you know? And that doesn't always happen, even if it gets out there. But getting it out there is the first step. And what I learned, having worked myself and known many small distributors, small publishers, and small filmmakers, and even larger ones, is that it is the movies we see once upon a time in Hollywood, all these movies that talk about the filmmaking process and getting a movie made, there are also those that talk about how someone will get sort of to be indelicate, the Shaft. They won't get treated right by their distributor when Big they do time. Get a distributor.
Oh, I can tell you stories where this all looked great, and then the regime changed, and the guy mm-hmm. said, "I'm not going to make that a hit." Then everybody said, Absolutely. "Why did we fire that guy?" Bury
Intentionally
that
tank a production. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Well, and I will throw this out because they don't care; they're a huge corporation. But Warner Brothers, you know, making an entire series or an entire film that people think is going to go out there, and people are going to see their hard work and know their name, and then literally not releasing it because the way things work now, they can claim a huge tax break by claiming a loss.
They figured, you know, it was worth more money dead than it was. What was the film they just made? What was the big sci-fi? What was it? Batgirl? No.
Batgirl. Yeah. They did it with a lot of animated series. And so it's a devastation to the creative community when things like that happen. But it is the business side coming in. And while there are lots of great businesses, especially, it's like the music industry this way, as famously, the film industry has a lot of predatory organizations and people. And so I found that a lot of these small filmmakers, they get eaten up. Absolutely. They'd be approached by, a distributor who is like, hey, we distribute everywhere. We've got our movies in Barnes & Noble and Walmart and right. et cetera. And they do. But their contracts, they know that these people who don't, they're normal people. They don't have a huge amount of money, right? They can't have an entertainment lawyer on retainer yeah. for, you know, however many thousands or hundreds of dollars a month, right? They don't have those people. So they get these contracts, and then they'll have people, if they ask, walk them through it, but it's you have to trust. You're really trusting a company that may be predatory to be honest with you. And that's not in their best interest.
Not in their best interest, right?
Exactly. I have two filmmakers right now that we're in the process of distributing their films who completely lost all rights to some of their biggest movies because of who they signed with, because they signed and then they found out that, oh, well, I'm supposed to get this amount of profit from sales. And they're like, yes, but after we recoup our advertising budget, and you'll never know what the advertising budget was, and you'll never know how much to make. So you get zero money. And then what's worse, they can own the property outright. So your name's on it, but you can never use it.
Famous example of the guy, John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater, who lost the right to play his own music. I'm from the 60s, Creedence Clearwater, huge. And because of the contractual obligations, he can't play his own music anymore.
That's right.
Taylor Swift getting upset, and she's going to go re-record all that stuff because that's not yours, it's mine. No, look at the fine print. You were desperate, you were young, we made a deal, and you knew what it was, and it's ours. And we can sell it, and we can do all sorts of things with it that you don't like, sorry.
Exactly. And you'd think that you would be able to go, you know, into a court and people would be able to use their judgment, right? We all know that that's unfair, but contracts are contracts, and a good lawyer will be able to hold a contract that has clear writing. It may not have been clear to you, but it's clear
or
to them.
Or drag it out so long. I could give you, we could talk for hours offhand, where people knew they were right and knew they were going to win. And the lawyer said, give it up. Because it will cost you millions of dollars to keep litigating this for years, paying people on retainer, all so that, yes, you can recover this damages and the reward, but you got to spend the money first to get it, and will bury you in litigation.
And they know you don't, especially as a recording artist or a small filmmaker. They know you made the money. I mean, you made the film with whatever you had and possibly some more from other people or credit. Right. And so they know you do not have the task. And that's unfortunate. So when I saw this, because basically we started during COVID, I'd always wanted to start a film podcast because, you know, podcasting like this, it's a great way to get information out there. Right. People can consume it for free. And it's just, it's fun to share your passion and your information with an audience.
Right.
But of course, during COVID it was a great time to have time. It was a bad time to launch a podcast because every celebrity that was out of work launched a podcast. So who am I going to listen to? Am I going to listen to the celebrity that I love? Right. Or am I going to listen to somebody I've never heard of?
Right.
So it quickly became, we had a cult following, right? As again, a cult following. We had a very niche, dedicated following to the podcast, which we still have. I'm very grateful for. And many of them are our customers now. But there was no real chance of making money that would sustain it. Like I could pay for it because I had a day job.
Right.
So it was it was my hobby, and hobbies are allowed to cost money without making money.
And most podcasts, truthfully, if you look at the millions made, I would say 95% of them are just passion projects. I'm doing this for fun. I like few people really think I'm going to make a living if this turn into business. Yep. So cut to the chase. How did you decide from a podcast, a fan podcast about this cult fringe world of movies that you found so fascinating, which so many others do too? This is, you're not alone. How did you decide to turn that into a business? And what is the business? Do you distribute them? Do you produce them?
What do we do? So we have a very specific, we're sort of lucky. One thing I'll say to people who want to start a business out there, I don't know how you could start a business that you're not passionate about, because that's the kind of person I am. I would lose interest and I would sabotage myself, right? If I didn't care about it. Like if it was just if I started something I didn't care about.
Right.
About it. But
and
also,
some people can. I can just run a shoe store. I don't care. A shoe store makes money and I will do that. Right.
Exactly. And more power to you, right? It gives you the money to do the things you want to do. In my case, I had a very hard time, you know, working a day job I don't care about kind of thing that doesn't really, it just pays the bills and gets me to do what I want. I have a hard time with that.
Me too. Go ahead.
So, So I was like, well, my wife's very helpful. Having a support structure in your personal life is super helpful. She's like, well, what can you do with this? And I was like, well, I know a lot of filmmakers who are self-distributing their movies either for free on YouTube or they're making DVDs, because everybody kind of has the ability to burn a basic recordable DVD on their computer, et cetera. You know, they're selling some copies and they have fans, but it's nothing to make up for any cost. They're not making any money.
Right.
And then there are some who get a movie that a distributor thinks is enough to actually get some sales. And then they kind of get, they get tricked out of their income and their property.
Right.
So I was like, this isn't fair.
They lose control of it, really. They lose control of it.
Absolutely. And I was like, okay, what skills do I have? Well, I have, because of my ADD, which causes me to make it hard to do a job I don't care about, I have a lot of previous experience and equipment. The podcast gave me a lot of film and computer equipment already. I also had a background after high school in illustration. So I'm like, okay, I can whip together packaging fairly easy for me. So what do I have? Well, I can spend X amount of time, right? So I have the time, I have this, and I have equipment. So with a couple more pieces of equipment that I can buy used, I can actually produce Blu-ray discs, which are less easy to produce for most people. And I can do a nice package that looks professional. And, but what can I cannot do? Well, I can't get it right now into, say, Barnes & Noble,
right?
Because I don't have the distribution method to do that many orders.
Right.
And I don't have the capital to do what's necessary to get the contracts in order, et cetera. So I said, okay, I know all these things. What can I do with that? And that's exactly what I did. I have duplicators, I have disc printers, and I have the knowledge, and I learned a lot, because you're going to have to learn a lot no matter what you do. Right. You can be an expert, you still don't know everything about your business. And then I can reach out to these filmmakers and say, what can I get them that is fair? And also so I can continue to grow, because that's a big thing. I think of Levi's jeans. They're in financial trouble all the time, but their employees love them.
Yeah.
You know, and so I've seen them take pay cuts, right? I follow them because I love their business model. Pay cuts to keep other people on staff. How many companies do that?
I didn't know they did that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I love that. And so I was like, well, I can give filmmakers about 20% of every sale, which is a lot for most of them. And so if I'm selling competitive rate with other, like, boutique, we call them, distributors of movies, like off the beaten path movies, I can give them basically the same or a little more, a little less cut of what I get to put back in.
Is this sort of like the Rhino Records model? Rhino Records, I don't know the story of how they came out of, but they picked up old records that nobody had wanted anymore here and started distributing classic, they'd call them classic, forgotten records, and then some oddball records, I think Dr. Demento and some of these other things. And all of a sudden, they've turned it into a big company.
That's
my impression of it. It's a pretty big, real brand now that isn't just oddball stuff that nobody wants.
Exactly. And there's lots of them like that. I mean, Something Weird Video is one that a lot of cult fans know. And they've had a lot of changes and things, but it's a passion project. And because of that, now everybody in that niche field knows them. Vinegar Syndrome, you'll see their movies. They've released some big name movies as well, but a lot of smaller movies or forgotten movies or 80s genre movies, the same thing. The owner found a huge store of adult films, actually, and said, well, what can we do with these? Like, this is film history in some way. And so bought them and then sort of parlayed that into working into more mainstream films and genre films. And now it's a wonderful big company. The difference is some of them already had capital, right? These small business people, we don't often have a lot of capital.
So how did the SBDC then help you? Because it's a free organization. You stumbled upon them. Lisa is a great person. You can listen to the episode we did with her on this show. How did they help you make this a business? What was a passion originally, which turned into a podcast, which is still a passion. Maybe it can be a business where I package and take these custom niche things and put them together and sell them as DVDs. Or I assume you have an online distribution or a club.
Yes.
People can
sell. If you go to cultandclassicfilms.com, CULTAND classicfilmsfilms.com.
All spelled out, right.
Yeah, you can buy the movies that we release. We generally do about one every month. So sometimes we take off, but 8 months a year we put out movies. But you can buy them there. And then if you want a discount, you can actually subscribe to our Patreon, which you can find through there. And you get them just directly delivered every month with some extras. And we pack our stuff with extras. That was something I'm like, what do fans like? They like things with it. Yes. So we have signed posters, Pogs, I can't use the word. Pogs is a copyrighted term, but in the 90s was very popular. These milk cap toys, people. We put a set of five of those for the movie with every collector's edition. So all sorts of neat things.
Is there commentary, the director's commentary?
Yes, behind the scenes, trailers, all sorts of stuff. We pack as much as we can in, and we have those things because these are passion projects from these filmmakers, right? But we put that out. So I was like, I have all of these things I can do. I have printing presses. I have these little things. How can I do it? And how can I make it sustainable? Yeah. Because it'd be great to get, say, on my first one, 30 orders day one. But if I can't make 30 orders on my time, I'm tanking my own business by growing too fast.
Yes. And people do that all the time. I'm going to overreach, and suddenly get an order for 1,000, and that 1,000 kills me, puts me under. I don't have the equipment, I don't have the time, I can't deliver, and now I got a bad reputation, and blah, blah, blah.
Yes, and I'll tell you one thing. I almost, for me, it's a guarantee that that happened. It did happen. It's happened a couple of times. You know, it's they say growing pains in business for a reason. It's not a bad problem to have, but you have to handle it right. You have to communicate with your customers and your licensors or whoever, your vendors, whoever you're working with. And that's the number one key I can throw out there. But as far as SBDC and Lisa and Ryan Stoll, like they gave me the guidance to put what I wanted to do into both technical compliance, right? I needed these licenses. What did I need? You think you need a business license, which you do, and then maybe you pay a tax every year or whatever. There's a lot more to it than that.
Well, because you're going to pay royalties and other things. I don't know if you're paying BMI or ASCAP.
Contracts, yes. And also like your city's seller's permits, all sorts of little things that they helped me know what I needed to do. And they helped me set goals for, okay, well, you need this. This should be the next thing you tackle. What is a timeline you can do this in? And that super helped.
Because they're looking at it as a business. And yes. Once they get past the novelty of what you're doing and the fringe aspect of it, it still has basic parameters. You have to produce a product at a profit. You have to deliver on time. You have to be able to do it consistently. You have to be able to scale it and grow it. All of those things are step-by-step procedures that people like Lisa have walked through for giant corporations or startups. And you're getting the expertise. Somebody, I forgot her exact story, but she's worked with some heavyweight people.
She's fantastic. And everyone's fantastic. I didn't work with a single person who didn't give me invaluable advice that I hadn't gotten elsewhere. But here's the thing. People are listening, maybe people who are listening who just happened to stumble upon this or because they're Cult and Classic film fans and know me already. This is free. This seriously... Thousands and thousands of dollars of consultation is absolutely free because of the funding they get from
the state and the SBD.
The state and the government. And here's the thing about it. If you're like me and, you know, especially in our political climate now wanting to do, I mean, I do fringe films. It is not something that, and this is irrelevant to personal political beliefs. It's not something that say many political parties are going to be okay with. There's some that don't want to fund. They don't want funding to go to someone like this company who just get, it's an art company. We let people do their art and communicate with
whole argument fans. About NPR. Are they just funding bizarre work? Why are the taxpayer paying for some strange picture of I don't know, pick some religious thing or anything. Right. And people are saying, because it's a statement. And they're saying, that's not a statement I want to fund or support. I don't know why we're even giving money to these people.
And it is sort of an all or nothing thing. I'm sure there are people who have a great business who is not something I like. Right. But that's not the point. The point is that we are essentially paying taxes to help fund the small business organization, SBDC and the branches. And it's like the one thing I always say in the literature background, we always say that the one thing the government did right was libraries, right? It's a joke, but it's also partially true. Libraries are a great free service to the community. Well, this is one of those things that it blows my mind that more people don't know about. The amount of help and guidance, specific, concrete guidance day to day that I was able to get from Lisa and Ryan was, truthfully, could I have done this? Yes. Maybe. Would it have been as good? Would I have missed so many stumbling blocks? Would I have had such a good time doing it and faith in it? Absolutely not.
Or would you fail and learn from the failure? Trial and error means more error. And when you're a small business, a startup business, a fringe filmmaker where every dime counts and you're trying to scrape up pennies under your sofa to make that last little effort here. Can you afford not just the time, but the money to waste learning? Or is it better to avoid learning? You know, they always say it's best learning by mistake. Maybe, but it kills you too in the process. You learn in the process. If I had the money, this is how I'd do it again, once you've run out of the money.
Right. And that's the thing is they, as you said, they have so much experience in the real world, in an area that I could not afford to be in. Right. This is not something that, well, I'll get it later when I'm established. Like, certainly you can go and get help for your business. And I urge you to do that, even if you have a new business or you're having struggles. But this is the kind of help that big corporations get they start businesses to lessen their risks and know they're doing something right and safely. And you are getting it for free. Like I it's on my agenda. It's been too long to touch base with Lisa and Ryan to say, here's where we're at. Here's all the stuff that's doing, because they help me.
The only thing they ask in return, as they tell me, is just give us some metric facts. Show us, did you increase some sales? Did you hire some people? Mm-hmm. Did you grow your business in some tangible way? So they can report back to the government and see, it wasn't a waste.
We did it.
And we're not trying to pick winners or losers. Anybody who comes with any kind of business, a sewing business, a boba shop, cult film things, we don't judge and say, oh, that's crazy. That'll never work. I'm not going to waste our time on that. No, they just jump in and they say, okay, I may not understand it. Tell me more about it. And then they do some research and say, well, it seems like you need this. You got to do this. And how about this? And they bring basic knowledge to it. It's a fantastic service. Well,
and I know we're going to wrap up real quick. I just want to say one quick thing. They also give you the confidence, because a lot of people will tell you, well, that's not really broad. There's not a lot of people that are going to do that. How can you expand your market? That's not what you need to hear when you're starting a business. As we just said, my business is very niche. It's not for everyone. That's a good market because they're spending money and I know who to target. I don't have to shoot for everyone. So you get some unintentionally bad advice from people in your life. And that's okay. They're trying to help, but they don't understand. Whereas people like these consultants, they understand.
Yes.
Lisa understands, Ryan understands.
So and one of the things that they always say is there's riches in niches. You know, Amazon built a huge business off of billions of little niches. They sell Lithuanian folk art or something, things that five people only want. But they've got 5 million of those separate products that each have some little dedicated, passionate group of people, and they can't get this stuff anywhere else. And that's what you're offering. So I really think it's there. And I will support, if anybody's listening to this, the other quote I was going to, we're going to talk for a few minutes offline. I'm going to give you some other people I know from my days in the film business here. But one of the people we had on one of our other shows here at OC Talk Radio was a guy who runs an art house here in Orange County, the Frida Cinema, and named after Frida, whatever her last name is, Coalo, and the famous Mexican revolutionary artist, painter and everything here. He has made a living off of showing many of the kinds of films, ultra low budget, forgotten classics, cult films that are panned in the beginning, but people love, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers or that kind of stuff that's gone on to cult classic here. Little Shop of Horrors with Jack Nicholson and a low budget Roger Corman film that. All these kinds of things. It takes those plus new films, plus genre films, LGBTQ films. I didn't know there were such things, or foreign films. And the big one, horror. Everybody loves it. There's millions of these little low-budget horror films. I don't know how you find them. I don't know where you see them. But they're being made, and it's a big profit category. And occasionally one of them, like Saw, will pop up into the upper ranks. But most of them stay low-budget and low-key. And there's a love for them out there, and that's why people keep making these things. And that's kind of what you're showing, some of that stuff too.
And, you know, there's just a lot of people who are good people who want to make movies and send them to you. And I'm helping them do that, and I want to. And, you know, hey, we released Pulgasari in the best form it's ever been seen, which is an infamous North Korean film that they were trying to compete with Godzilla, but they made it by kidnapping essentially a South Korean director and tricking the Japanese company Toho, who does Godzilla still, into coming thinking it was China. So they made this film, but we can't pay them for it, and we wouldn't. It's a dictatorship, and it's illegal also in the US. And the director's passed away. So I was like, hey, we've got the technology. I can make this best version ever and pack it with extras, like the author who wrote a book about it. He came on and did a special feature. What do we do with it? Well, my purpose for the business is not to just make money. In fact, that's not
money allows you to do more of what you love to do.
I want it to be my full-time job eventually, but I was like, well, I don't have a filmmaker to pay. I could keep that, or I could donate those proceeds to Link, Liberty in North Korea. And that's what we did. And you know what? That kind of goodwill in your business, this is another tip, it pays off. People listen, people see, people care. And so when you do that, you build goodwill in the community, and people want to support your business. So just, you know, it's hard not to look at money first as far as income.
Well, but I was thrilled to hear this thing. One, because it's a fascinating subject to me, having the years I did spend in the film business on the fringe as a press agent, not necessarily making it, but wanting to be a screenwriter, meeting people that were. And then through the world I lived in, the people that made low budget and slasher films and biker films and all sorts of the Roger Corman kind of world of films that only got shown in a drive-in or direct-to-DVD. Mm-hmm. And then this whole new world of horror films and low budget things that people are just hooked on. Again, all this stuff that I find fascinating. What it shows me is the range of the SBDC. And forgive me, I don't want Absolutely. To offend you, but you've got to be one of the wildest, weirdest, wackiest, way out there businesses that I've ever come across
I take it on pride. That's nice to hear.
And if they can help you, think of what they can do for everybody else. So I just think it's a great story. And I hope you the best of success. Give us the website if people want to tune into your films and your world. How do they find you?
Yes, it is cultandclassicfilms.com. I realize that sometimes I speak very fast and people think I'm saying Colton, like the name. Yeah. But no, it is cult, C-U-L-T, right. And then A-N-D, classicfilms.com. And you can find our podcast there. You can subscribe wherever your podcasts are found. You can check out our shop, see what movies we have. Our newest release is a great Native American-made film. It's a Cherokee film, a horror film, slasher film, actually.
A Cherokee made. Horror film, just what That's I was right. looking
and,
for
and,
here.
And yeah. A queer-led Cherokee horror film filmed in the Cherokee capital of Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And so you just, there are things that you don't know about. Check it out. You'll have fun.
Open your eyes and see what's out there. It's more than just what's at the local Metroplex here, the local movie theater. There's stuff being made, some of which will stay in the shadows forever, some of which will pop up and make a bunch of money, some of which will turn into famous directors and actors and stuff like Jack Nicholson. I think that was his first film with Roger Corman, yeah. A Little Shop of Horrors. And it's low budget, and it's corny, and it's crazy, and yet it's turned into musicals on Broadway and big movies and all these things here. So you never know. Yeah. You never know what you're going to get, the early seeds, if you want to see where these people start. Steven Spielberg didn't start with Jaws or something here. They started
Francis Ford Coppola made adult films.
I didn't know. Did they a lot of them have done that? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or they made some real weird thing and it only played in film circuits and college circuits, right. But that's
San Francisco. That's that was it.
That's how they got noticed. So you can notice these things and you can catch them early on, or you can just explore ideas. And again, just because they're so bad, they're so different, or sometimes they're just so different that they're way out there. And that's why they can't reach a mainstream audience. They're breaking all the rules. And if you're into film, it's interesting to see people stepping outside the boundaries here. I think it's fascinating. I would love to see the Korean Godzilla kind of film.
I will get you a copy.
My grandson's here. You know, he's 10. Oh, my God. He's crazy about anime and all these. Anime is a whole world of, I don't know where all these anime movies come from, but he knows them all now. He watches them on YouTube. He's fascinated. He actually wants to go to Japan now here.
That's great. I can't make any promises, but there may be some anime coming out by the end of next year from Culture Classic Films.
Keep me on the list for that one, because my grandson's just a crazy nut about it here, as are many kids these days here.
That's right.
Thank you so much for opening up the world. I wish we could explore it more. I hope you'll come back again. And great success. One last time, if they want to learn anything about this fringe world of film, they should visit cultandclassicfilms.com.
Correct. And you can find us on Instagram at Cult and Classic Films. I run that directly, as well as Facebook and youtube.com/@cultandclassicfilms.
If nothing else, and listen to the podcast and listen to some people talking about, see what he's out there and see if any of this has any appeal to you, or wants to try something. You know, don't just eat hot dogs and hamburgers every day. Get out there and try some other, sample some other stuff.
Eat it all. Eat it all. Everything.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. Say your name correctly this time. I don't want to bungle it one more time here.
Nathan Wyckoff.
Nathan Wyckoff. Thank you so much for joining us and for all you shared with us about your business and the business help you got from the Small Business Development Center. Thanks. As we conclude another episode of the Profit Talks podcast, we hope we've empowered your entrepreneurial spirit. Reach out to us to connect with our experts, and let's take your business to the next level. Keep those dreams alive, keep pushing forward, and stay tuned for more. And if you liked what you heard in today's podcast and you want your business to reach new heights, just contact us at profittalkspodcast.org
or call us at 1-800-616-7232. That's 1-800-616-7232. So until next time, keep thriving.